very strange, so far away from you, this podium. Yeah. It's okay if you have to get up and leave in the middle. Don't worry, don't let that prevent you from coming forward. So, hello, my name is Monica, and I'm visiting from North Carolina in the United States. It's really nice to be here in this place that I hear is the longest running anarchist gathering in Europe, maybe in the world. It's very exciting, so thank you for having me. A little bit of context about me is that I'm one of the editors of Rolling Thunder. It's a magazine that is published by the Crime Think Collective, a journal of anarchist analysis, and also help with some of the other Crime Think books and other projects. And then probably more of my organizing work is with prisoners against the prison system, also with Earth First organizing against resource extraction and for eco-defense, and then also with alternative healthcare. So I have a lot of different things, but here I want to talk mostly about sort of crime think related anarchist analysis of what is going on in the US currently. And I'm hoping that together we can figure out some of the lessons that are useful for y'all here and some of the things that are common. And I'm hoping that also you can share some of the stories about what is going on here. So I'm a little bad with time, and I don't have a watch. If somebody wants to give me a heads up when we are close, that would be great. And also I'll be here all weekend, so I hope that if we don't have a lot of time to talk, that you'll come up and talk with me afterwards. So a little bit of context for anarchist organizing in the US. In the last probably 10 years, the anarchist focus has been increasingly narrowing, right? Folks have been working on a variety of different projects that have been successful in their topical areas, but very, very specifically. So a lot of work has been going on against the border and the increasing systems of deportations and detentions that are happening in the US. Also a lot of organizing with people that are inside prisons, both folks that were comrades who are now behind bars, and also more social prisoners who have been politicized in prison. Also against police brutality, right, with a response to a handful of police murders that have happened in the last couple of years that have been highly publicized. And also against a lot of the really destructive resource extraction that's going on in the States. But these projects have largely remained quite separated from one another, very limited to the social bodies that are directly affected by those issues. And it's been quite challenging in the last years to create a narrative that really ties all of these things together. There's also been a marked loss of anarchist social spaces. So a lot of long-running info shops and DIY venues have closed down in the last years. A lot of long-running, large-scale national and regional conferences and gatherings have stopped happening. And there have been a lot less frequent mass mobilizations, so the more informal anarchist networks that were quite strong some time ago have also deteriorated. There have been some exciting moments of sort of collective and broad-based revolt, but for the most part, I think things have been quite quiet in the US. And the first indication of the influence of, well, since the financial crisis hit, the influence from the austerity measure riots here in Europe and the uprising in North Africa last year was a teacher's strike in occupation that happened in Wisconsin. It was public workers, teachers specifically, but public workers generally, who were demonstrating for collective bargaining rights, right? And it became an occupation of the Capitol building, which was a really exciting thing. I was getting text messages every couple of hours from friends who were giving updates about what was going on. It got to the point where there was some minor rioting when the police, who are also public workers and were also in this same fight for collective bargaining, went on strike. So it was this very strange moment that happened before the whole Occupy Wall Street movement began, where it was this sort of spark of possibility, right? And yet, the teachers were not able to win collective bargaining rights. I think it's really interesting to me that at the same time, it was possible for people to overthrow the most highly funded dictatorship in the world, and in Wisconsin, teachers were not able to win their collective bargaining rights. Right? And I think that this says something about the political moment that we're in, that we can't win concessions for ourselves as individual groups, that we have to figure out how to fight together to start from the places where we have collective vulnerability to the economic system. To put this another way, right, we know that right now, especially, but always, capitalism is struggling to reorganize itself, and there is particular instability, and so nobody is maintaining a fixed role within capitalism, and so defensive struggles that struggle for maintaining this fixed position, they're losing struggles. So this is the context that the Occupy movement happens. It's frankly the biggest new development in the US, and it's affected anarchist organizing in a variety of ways. Right? I'm guessing that for the most part, people have heard something about Occupy, but just to get on the same page, it started with this occupation on Wall Street, and it spread really quickly in the United States. I live in North Carolina. It's a pretty small, relatively small state. There are maybe 3 or 4 major cities in the whole state. And at one point, there were something like 14 different occupies happening across the state in big cities, in little cities, in medium-sized cities, in rural places that I had never heard of. Each city's occupy seems to have had a unique character, right? But I think from talking with friends all over the country and a little bit in other countries, that there are similar tensions and sort of common threads. I'm curious how much they carry over to the occupy things that have been happening in Europe. It's been interesting to know that what remains the most uniform is the form that each occupy takes, right? It's a public forum, somewhat rotating cast of participants that uses the consensus process for decision making through general assemblies. But it's also been interesting talking to participants in different places that you can get a radically different idea of what the purpose is, what the goal is, right? For some, it seems like it is something vague, like a struggle for economic or social justice. Others have very specific economic reforms that they are striving for. And then, you know, you get everything from a very well-articulated anarchist analysis to people who are just there because they are outraged and fed up. They can't imagine anything else working, but they know that they want a totally different system. So the moment that these occupies started to spread, it was really exciting. I was talking with old friends across the country every day, hearing a new story, and it seems like a lot of my anarchist friends who had not been very involved in organizing for the last years suddenly were activated again, right? Talking on the phone with people that I hadn't seen in years, there was this slight hesitant sense of possibility, yeah? I think it was really exciting because especially a lot of older radicals came out of the woodwork. People that had been very active in radical politics in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s that had largely disappeared from my lifetime of anarchist organizing. I met somebody who used to be in the Weathermen, who lives in my town, who I had never known, who now is a regular part of my life, who came out because of what was going on with Occupy. I think that its broadness has been one of its strengths, yeah? And it's, especially in the US, it's been rare to see so many people together. During the anti-globalization movement, anarchists always were organizing with other radicals, other kinds of liberals and progressives, and there was a space for our ideas to be more defined, right? There was always some space of conflict where things were becoming more clear. And lately it has not been like this. So this Occupy movement has been exciting to see a space where so many different ideas are rubbing up against each other. Yeah. It's been interesting also to see the way that people that would otherwise describe themselves as liberal, progressive, or just generally radical really dove into explicitly anarchist organizing structures, right? People's commitment to those principles sometimes even seemed to cause a moment of crisis. I saw it a number of times where somebody's desire to be in charge and to direct the process that was happening suddenly was in conflict with their desire for direct participation. There was this moment where I was co-facilitating a general assembly with somebody, which was a rarity for me, but this woman that I was working with was, I think, newly interested in anarchist politics. And we were outside, and it was getting really sunny, right? The sun was shifting, and so a lot of the crowd was in the sunshine. And I said something like, oh, well, maybe we should shift to the shade. You know, she said, no, you can't just tell people to shift to the shade. We have to stop and get consensus to see if people want to move to the shade or not, right? And I said, no, I think it's okay. We can just suggest that if people want to move into the shade, they can, and we can shift a little bit. We don't have to go through everything. So it's been interesting, and I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, it's this sort of copycat phenomenon, right? Because what happened at Occupy Wall Street was they were using only the consensus process. They were really focused on direct participation. And so if you are in Occupy happening somewhere else, no matter what your political ideas are, you will use consensus and you will aspire to a direct participatory model. It also has meant that people who I think otherwise look down upon anarchists a little bit have started to turn to anarchists in the States, right? Suddenly anarchists are the people that have experience with the consensus process. They're the people that have experience organizing in these ways. And there is a sudden sense of legitimacy that was not there in the last years and certainly not a decade ago. Another quite prominent tension has been between the desire for representative solutions, right, and acting out of autonomous sites of power. This is not a surprise with people with so many different kinds of political affiliations or inclinations, maybe. You could see this even in the beginning with Occupy Wall Street, right? The original Adbusters call, this magazine that first called for Occupy Wall Street, asked people to get together in the square and consent on one demand that they would then make to the world that this is what they wanted. And everyone refused to do so, right? Refused to engage in this kind of ridiculous way with the legislative process. And I think this kind of tension, though, has continued, right? Where consistently there's a question about, okay, we have an occupation, but in the States, in many places it has meant, do we get a permit or not? You know, because we can be an Occupy, but do we need to go through the legitimate channels? Does that make us safer to be doing what we are wanting to do? And this comes into maybe the most contentious tension, right, is the question of violence. It's a question that I think I thought that maybe we were somehow over the question of what violence is, how violence is used, right? Whether the police are there to protect us or whether they are a part of the 99%. I thought that this was past because the last few anarchists or the last few mass mobilizations that happened in the States, maybe because there was such a void of other organizing, anarchists really took the lead and were able to create agreements of solidarity, of non-cooperation with the state, and of a respect for a diversity of tactics with local progressives and other radicals in their areas, right? And I think that I was almost a little bit surprised when this came up again in such a fierce way with occupations here or in the States. Is this a question that has continued to be an issue in Europe? Yes, an ongoing debate.
In Occupy,
not really.
No. It was not discussed at all.
Well, not discussed at all.
Oh. Yeah, I think in anarchist circles, right, the question is essentially over, but certainly in dealing with people in the Occupy movement, I think in every Occupy that I have heard from, there is an anarchist contingent who is struggling to figure out how to engage with this question appropriately, right, how to make a set of guidelines that helps people to get past this. There has been a lot of talk in the US media lately, some maybe liberal pundits wrote this big controversial piece that said, Black Bloc anarchists are the cancer of Occupy. Has this also come across here? It has been a big scandal the last couple of months. And a lot of people who have in the past organized with anarchists have come out saying, yes, that anarchists are separate from Occupy, that they are the good protesters and there are the illegitimate protesters. So I want to read a little something from this pamphlet that we've put out called The Illegitimacy of Violence and the Violence of Legitimacy. There is no such thing as nonviolence in the state of affairs, in the culture that we live in. The closest that we can hope to come is to negate the harm or threat posed by the proponents of top-down violence. And when so many people are invested in the privileges this violence affords them, it's naive to think that we could defend ourselves and others among the dispossessed without violating the wishes of at least a few bankers and landlords. So insisting on asking whether an action is violent, instead of asking whether an action is violent, we might do better to simply ask, does it counteract power disparities or reinforce them? Right, this is the fundamental anarchist question. Legitimacy is one of the currencies that are unequally distributed in our society, through which its disparities are maintained. Defining people or actions as violent is a way of excluding them from legitimate discourse, of silencing and shutting out. This parallels and reinforces other forms of marginalization. A wealthy white person can act nonviolently in ways that would be seen as violent were a poor person of color to do the same thing. In an unequal society, the defining of violence is no more neutral than any other tool. Defining people or actions as violent also has immediate consequences. It justifies the use of force against them. So I live in a quite small town in North Carolina. The anarchists in my town have been really involved in framing the context of the occupation in our town. And after some weeks of just normal occupation in the city square, things had come to quite a standstill. And a few weeks later, we had an anarchist book fair that was already planned. So after the anarchist book fair, there was a march that led to a building downtown that was abandoned. It was opened and the march flooded into the abandoned building, right? This is sort of a big deal in the US because there is not such a strong history of squatting in the US. It's really challenging to access private property. It's maybe the thing that the police defend against the most, yeah? It was a really exciting moment. All of these people from the book fair came in, right? It was on a main thoroughfare, so people who were walking around for dinner or going out in the night, it was a Saturday night, were coming in to see what was going on. There were pamphlets that had been made explaining why the building was being occupied and proposing some alternative use for the building, right? There was a pamphlet that was handed out with a floor plan that had a library and a free clinic, just some of the basic things that you would have in a social center. And it was really provocative for what was going on in the Occupy movement. People who I have known from newly getting involved in the Occupy movement came slowly, one by one, were having conversations about why there was an occupation in a town, that they were involved in the Occupy movement and they didn't know about it. Right. Okay. I feel like I'm losing my place a little bit. Sorry. The conversations were complicated largely because
because of people's commitment to the consensus process, right? I think there was this conception that was broken with this small action that everything that happens that is some kind of radical organizing in our city has to happen through this Occupy, right? I think that this is, this became the dominant paradigm that anything that we needed to do, we would go through the General Assemblies, right? And everyone would consensus upon something. And that if something happened outside of that, it was breaking down the consensus of that moment. Okay, so the occupation goes on. It was very exciting. A few people stayed the night. The next day, the book fair had a whole list of workshops that were scheduled to happen. So they all happened in this occupied building. And slowly, people who had been the night before, I think, a little bit upset and a little bit surprised at the occupation, they started to turn around a little bit. It was interesting to watch them get more and more involved in the things that were happening in this occupied building. Like people were cleaning up the building, they were building different structures. And slowly, people were starting to see Okay, so let me maybe back up a little bit and give a story. There's a person that I have met recently. Her name is Amanda. She's amazing. She has lived in the town where I live for probably 30 or 40 years. She's middle-aged, single, black woman. She came out to the first Occupy event that happened, and she decided that she didn't know exactly what her place would be, so she started to organize with food and picking up the trash. She came out to every single thing that happened, and it was clear always to see that she was moving from this place of inspiration, right, of this fiery passion about everything that is wrong in the culture that we live in, about the way that people are thrown away in our society. And when the question of violence and nonviolence arose, I was surprised to hear her defend so strongly this position of nonviolence, right? Because she speaks with such an enthusiasm and speaks with such a fire. I was surprised to hear the ways that she was afraid of, or maybe not afraid, I was surprised to hear the ways that she shied away from any kind of history of militancy, of property destruction, of seizure of property. And Amanda came to this occupied building. She had been at every Occupy in the plaza, right? And participated fully, and she came to this occupied building. And at first, she was one of the people who said to me, "Why didn't I know that this was happening?" And you know, I said, "I'm not really sure. I don't actually know who organized this occupation, but isn't it exciting that we can be here together? You know, several hundred of us in this building. That it is our space to do what we want with, and maybe it's okay just to enjoy it." No? And she hung around, she danced for a while, there was a DJ and some movies on the wall, and she left. I stayed there the night, and when I got up in the morning, she was one of the first to arrive, and she talked to a lot of people that day. By the end of the day, she was sweeping up rubble and dust, she was building a new kitchen, and the editor of our local paper came over to do interviews with people. He was frustrated that no one would talk to him, that no one wanted their pictures taken. And Amanda was the person who talked with him. By the end of the day, I overheard her explaining that this was anarchism in action, right? That this act of taking this public building was the most obvious thing that could happen in a town where there is so much private property that is empty, and so many people without homes, right? That it is becoming winter time, and there are dozens of people who are sleeping in the encampment that is, you know, the Occupy encampment that is down the street. They have nowhere to go. And that this was the thing that made the most obvious sense. I was really impressed by her, right? I was impressed that so much shifted for her in this day. And the most exciting thing, really, was that in the following days, her positions on violence and nonviolence totally shifted. I heard her at General Assemblies, day after day, suddenly defending the anarchist position, which was increasingly her position, right? I heard her defending the need for taking other buildings, for moving faster and bigger with more spectacular actions. I should say that this building occupation ended pretty swiftly, right? I would say that no one was prepared to hold this building, that maybe people thought that we could be in it and have a party for a few hours, because in the city that I live in, there is no precedent for a publicly squatted building. And we were there for a full night and the next day. And at some point, I heard a rumor that the police were coming for a raid. And so we had an emergency meeting to figure out what should happen, and decided that since we weren't really prepared to defend this building, that we would sort of call the police's bluff, right? Because we live in a very liberal town where the police generally are quite hands-off, and that if it seemed like the police really wanted to evict us, we would just leave and we would walk out, and that we could always come back another day. And so people left to get a few things. We thought that the raid was happening in about 2 hours, and so most of the people left the building, a few stayed, and maybe 25 minutes later, there was a SWAT team raid of the building. So they sent in fully militarized police with loaded assault rifles, and it was ridiculous, right? It's the main downtown street in a very small town, you know, 60,000 people, a town that prides itself on its liberal politics, and they sent in full SWAT team. People in the city were outraged about the SWAT raid, obviously. I was one of the maybe 7 people that were arrested, and I work at a restaurant that is just down the block. And so, you know, every day after this raid, I'm at the restaurant taking people's orders for food, and everyone is saying, I cannot believe that in our city, on a Sunday afternoon, they would send in those SWAT police officers after you, decent children, you know, the sort of typical story. I think the most important thing about this, really, though, is that the police play their hand really hard. They push the reality of who the real purveyors of violence are. And after this, the question of violence and nonviolence was sort of a non-issue in the Occupy that we were part of. So I want to read one other thing that a friend wrote in response to this article that alleges that the black bloc anarchists are the cancer of Occupy. My friend writes, "These generations, we who fantasized about Columbine and now only know metal detectors at school. We who expected September 11th and now only know the politics of terror. We who grew up as the world crumbled all around us and now only know the desert. We need to fight, and not just the ways our rulers deem justified and legitimate. As workers, we're excluded from unions, from collective arrangements of any kind. When we manage to find employment at all, it is meaningless labor that corresponds to our own superfluousness in the economy. We were raised by a generation so thoroughly defeated that it feared to pass on its history. We are the inheritors of every unpaid bill, of every failed struggle, the products of the insanely selfish individualism of advanced capitalism in North America. Our entire environment feels hostile, hence our hostility. The arguments for orderly, passive demonstrations of these liberal pundits miss all this. One doesn't sweep the floor in a house falling off a cliff. In a world that feels absolutely hostile and alien, every element of social life acquires a sinister glow. In this light, the black bloc appears as a ray of optimism because it creates an opening that leads through to the other side of despair. The new struggles increasingly take place outside of legitimate and traditional venues. When the factory was a contested site, the workers' movement was the most vibrant and decisive space of contestation. During the shift from a factory-centered economy to an economy integrating social life, we saw the emergence of social movements contesting social spaces. Now that social life has been fully subsumed within capitalism, the mutant offspring of the proletariat and the counterculture is appearing outside the legitimate parameters of the old movements. This explains the spread of antisocial violence, anonymous play, selfish or self-destructive revolt, and irony. What's happened in Oakland has been particularly interesting.
Om kwart over drie begint in de gymzaal het programma met Wim Baltussen, die als RNV-bestuurder zal ingaan op de positie van uitgebreide Polen en aanverwanten in de agrarische sector van ons land. Kwart over drie gymzaal.
The usually radical longshoremen's union. So the Occupy movement there pushed for a port shutdown in conjunction with the strike, right? They many people didn't go to work, and all the people who didn't go to work also went to the ports and shut down the ports that were working. It's, I think, clearly that the future of working class struggles is increasingly outside of the workplace, increasingly outside of a particular workforce. In Oakland, the general strike meant interrupting the functioning of the economy generally, right? There was this question, I think, around the student occupations that happened some years ago that kept getting raised in the media all across the country, where the media was saying, the people who are occupying the universities, they're not even students. They don't even have a legitimate right to be here. And I would say that if you are not a student, you have all the more legitimate right to occupy a university, right? Especially if you cannot afford the high tuition, crazy prices. Similarly, if you don't have a job, you're all the more entitled to interrupt somebody else's functioning workplace. I think one of the key forces that's been working within the Occupy movement as it relates to the anarchist movement is that it's been a bringing together of people who have nothing to lose with people who realize that in this culture they're losing everything. It's meant that the downwardly mobile middle class is working to find the commonality with the unemployed, with homeless, with people that are otherwise marginalized in our society. It means that I'm seeing radical professors in my town engaging for the first time with the homeless people who have been practicing the resistance culture that these professors have been teaching about. It means that the 60s radicals who have become social workers and continue to live sort of normal lives are suddenly organizing with the poor single mothers that otherwise are their clients. The last major tension, I think, that has definitely been a facet of this is this pull between the legitimacy or the centralization of the consensus process versus the physical encampment as a site of power. It means that as the weeks have moved on and many people were involved in the Occupy movement from the beginning, slowly people who have homes start to return to their homes, and slowly the encampment becomes increasingly populated by people who don't have homes. And the people who maybe are characterized otherwise as professional activists come in only for the consensus meetings, right? Whereas the encampment is the home of the people who are living there. And so I think a lot of the Occupy movements have sort of hit a plateau where there is this breakdown between who is living at the camp and who is participating in the meeting structure. It's clear that the encampments without any kind of movement have proved to be directionless, but also that the political movements that we have need to expand our physical sites of power. I think, for me, there are a lot of questions about what comes next out of this, right? The Occupy movement has sort of, it has reached its spike and started to falter off. There was a big May Day event that was planned in New York City. It was advertised as something that was going to be huge and spectacular, and I was hearing from friends of mine that they were organizing it for months and months. I wasn't there, I was in my hometown, but I was in New York City a few weeks ago, and maybe 2 weeks after May Day, talking with a friend, and he said, it was nothing really spectacular. There was a march, it was kind of predictable, a bunch of people were arrested, some windows were broken, it was the end of the day. But the thing that was really spectacular about it was that so many people who have been fighting with each other for the last couple of years managed to be all in the same room for meeting after meeting after meeting and organize something. And I think that is kind of the gift that has been given from Occupy, right, is that even though the people that have gotten involved through it are still in a process of changing, it's been a sort of reopening for anarchists in the U.S. Okay. I am curious to hear from people that have been involved either in Occupies here or if there are other similar things happening, if there are common threads between the things that I've been talking about and the things that you were seeing here. That's the first question. Okay, also I am open to just other questions, if there are other questions.
Like in the town where I come from, people around me where we worked with the squatting scene, they could not really take the Occupy movement really serious because we didn't know what they stand for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was my idea of the Occupy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the U.S. also there has been a lot of maybe hesitant participation in the Occupy movement because in the U.S. for sure it has been a lot of people who are newly coming into activism who are sometimes a little frustrating to work with for this reason and also a little bit directionless at times. But it has taken off in such an extreme way in the U.S. that it has become an obvious site out of which to organize, right? It's suddenly a new political social body that didn't exist before in the U.S. where if you were already organizing a project like we have a series of demonstrations at the prisons. Whenever somebody who is inside that is politically active is specifically targeted by the police. And usually our demonstrations are maybe a few dozen people. And since this Occupy has started, whenever there is some kind of demonstration like this, we can call on all of the people that have been excited about Occupy in our area. And you know, people come out in droves because suddenly there is this culture that knows what it means to go to a demonstration again. Yeah. Also, I think, of course, it's different because there is no squatting movement in the U.S. And so to have an occupation at all is a really big deal, right? To have an occupation of a public square is a big deal. To have an occupation of a building is, you know, almost unheard of in many places, even with people who have been involved in radical or anarchist politics for a very long time.
I think that's a crucial difference. If there wasn't a squatting movement, I think many more of us would have been much more enthusiastic about
Mm-hmm. I was sort of curious to know that Occupy happens as a phenomenon at all in Europe because it seems sort of out of place in a strange way. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I had the impression, but everybody can correct me if I'm wrong, I had the impression that Occupy was really mainly a US or Anglo-Saxon phenomenon because in Europe, of course, there was this 15th of March movement in Spain. And there was also an occupation movement going on in Israel with a different name.
Mm-hmm.
But especially when you look at the Netherlands or Germany, there were some occupied camps, but the general discourse about it was that these are like very small shoot-offs of something that is mainly happening somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this one occupied camp in The Hague, which really wasn't that big or impressive. And a lot of discussions which you mentioned, for example, on violence, were really not so present here because it was so small and in most places there indeed was sort of like a consent or agreement with the local government that this was okay if it would not stay too long or it would not cause too much trouble. And what especially in Germany played a role when the left looked at the Occupy movement was indeed like the discussion on is occupying, or at least in Europe, is this a leftist movement? Because there were all these zeitgeist freaks and a lot of like people with very awkward ideas. And there was also, at a certain point, for example, in Frankfurt, this case where an editor of the Junge Freiheit, which is like a very right-wing evildoer weekly, he was invited to some sort of seminar or discussion, whereas members of trade unions were excluded. They were not allowed to take part. So I think in when you look at Northern Europe, mm-hmm. it was very small. Most of the time there was a sort of pacification model, so local governments and there was indeed sort of like this discussion on what is the political outline of it. So
I think another important piece of context is about the left in the U.S., right? The left put a lot of energy into organizing for Obama to be president, and then when he became president, the left stopped organizing in a lot of capacities, and so anarchists have been left sort of alone in the political world of resistance. I think it's been one of the things that has particularly led to so much repression against anarchists. You know, the other main thing that I spend my time doing is supporting my friends who either have felony charges and are facing prison or who are in prison serving out sentences. And, you know, there's a feeling that this largely was possible because of the separation from the rest of the left movements, right, and that their total decline made it easier and easier to target us. So I think also one of the exciting things about this new social body that is created through the Occupy is that it's like a re-burgeoning of the left, only a much more anti-authoritarian left, right, a much more anti-capitalist left, which is an exciting thing, because the Occupy Wall Street started with this insistence on consensus. It's been very challenging for authoritarian groups to take control of what's happened within the Occupy, which is different from what has happened before, right? Authoritarians were very, very good at taking control of a lot of what was going on in the anti-globalization movement in the late 90s and early 2000s, and especially when it shifted direction to become this sort of vague anti-war movement. And so I think that is another thing that makes us particularly useful.
Yeah, I mean, we did have one quite big example in Europe, which was Amsterdam. One of the reasons we didn't have the violence discussion was because many of the people who defined themselves as anarchists had already left before the issue was on the table, right?
Mm.
I mean, it was really like, for the first few weeks, first the authoritarian left to left, like international socialista, because we didn't do the work they told us. And then about 2-3 weeks later, we saw the same from our anarchist people. They also left, so you had this like, it's very hard to pin down for people politically, and I think many people in the political left in Europe are very afraid of that,
mm-hmm.
and so they leave the movement. So it was a bit disappointing. I was quite disappointed in the political left in Europe in that sense. And of course, yeah, Amsterdam does have a squatting movement. Lots of people. Yeah, I also had to spend much energy in squatting and not so much on the occupation.
Mm-hmm.
But we were not that small. I mean, we had a we had 300-400 people staying there every night, which is not that small.
Mm-hmm. I saw one question in the very back and then one in front. So maybe in the very back first.
One question was about was Occupy alive in Europe? Yes, I think it was. But in Belgium, for example, we had the Indignados movement, who was walking from Spain to Brussels. And this was a very, very big event in Brussels. We had a very big manifestation. So I think it was alive very much.
Hmm. And here?
Yeah, I think what's part of why Occupy didn't really take off in, especially in the Netherlands, is partly the zeitgeist people who would be kind of or a conspiracy theorist, which made discussions take really a long time, which scared people off.
Mm-hmm.
But also because there were a lot of people for whom it was their first action, I know of Occupy sites where like the local squatting movement sort of unanimously decided to not be bothered with it anymore after they asked the police, like the people within the camp asked the police to arrest other people within the camp for drinking. And I think, yeah, it made it that sort of lack of distrust towards the police caused a lot of distrust within the camp, and well, especially for experienced activists, that was the last drop, and then it's not going to work. I don't want to risk being arrested for something someone else here does.
I think another important and interesting thing that has come out of this broad terrain of Occupy is a rejoining of a social analysis with an environmental analysis. I think in the US those have been quite separated for a very long time, and it seems like there's the beginnings of those two being much more integrated, which is really important in the US where we have crazy destructive resource extraction process going on in pretty much every bioregion. So I think the fight for the wild lands is becoming a little bit more broad, and an analysis about how climate change and the current economic systems are incorporated along with a social justice framework are materializing. One of the other things that I want to mention is there is an International Day of Solidarity for Marie Mason and Eric McDavid. They're two U.S. anarchist prisoners who have very long-term prison sentences. They're both doing over 20 years, coming up on June 11th. And if y'all are interested in that, I would love to talk to people more about this. Mm-hmm. Other questions?
I have a bit of question on like, because I've read a lot about also this 99% spring, a lot of discussion about it, but from so far away, it's sometimes hard to judge. Like a lot of this discussion on like who is co-opting who, like some people say, okay, this is just a liberal attempt to try to co-opt more radical occupying movement. A lot of people say like, it's useful that a lot of people get these trainings in organizing and direct action, civil disobedience processes. And for me it was also a bit strange because, well, some of these groups like Move On, as I mentioned, seem to be have backed Obama, or did in the past at least. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, you also have groups like the Ruka Society, who have, in my perspective, quite some tradition in radicalizing and people and giving them skills. Mm-hmm. But I don't really know what's your perspective on that. Like, is this whole attempt, which was an attempt, I think, in the spring to give people more skills to make sure that Occupy lasts longer, was it really more an empowering thing, or really an attempt to co-opt it?
I think that there were questions for people from a lot of different political perspectives about what would happen this spring, and I think that there were several different kinds of attempts to maybe to reinvigorate this thing that was a short-lived spike in the fall. I think largely it's not a surprise that some of the more liberal progressive groups had this kind of very narrowly focused skill set sort of directed approach to doing this, right? I think some anarchists had other ways. There were a couple of general strikes that were called that were somewhat successful, and a few other very sort of spectacular building occupations that happened also as a way to see if people could maybe come back to life. But I think the general consensus is that what happened with Occupy is more or less over, but what is exciting is this whole new social body of people that are explicitly anti-capitalist, that are thinking about how they want to organize themselves next. And I think the space of possibility is quite open, although there is no clear direction, perhaps.
Thank you.
What a reasonable answer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But also one of the things I wondered is because that I've seen in Belgium that not being involved likely in any Occupy in Belgium, but I heard some stories of people who went there, and then because I know there are also there's quite some people who have experience with these things like working with consensus, having like general assemblies,
mm-hmm.
who have organized no border camps, climate action camps, those things also in the past years. And when I heard of the few occupies which have happened, that in a lot of them there was like some new people, sometimes also with less, well, maybe with more authoritarian backgrounds or whatever, who were trying to organize something like that, or just new people who didn't have any skills. And then you see like, I hear stories about the first General Assembly, which is like completely falling apart because some people are talking for half an hour and you see that most people don't agree at all, but there is no really process of a way people know how to address this, and then people just leave and go on and think, oh, I never show back at something like that. So I want a bit like this perspective of giving out skills and making sure that as a movement you can grow by sharing skills. Or that can be like addressed better, because I had a feeling that it is in Belgium, it's completely collapsed on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has been a really interesting phenomenon to see a whole group of people that seem to come out of nowhere to decide that they will do things in this particular way that they have no experience with. Like, there was a general assembly that happened in the town next to the one where I live, and it was supposed to be a very big, important one. It was the general assembly where they decided whether or not they would have an occupation, and so friends asked me to come to facilitate as a neutral outsider with experience, and I was preparing for what I had been told would be a very challenging discussion, and was making some notes, and this very young girl that I had never met before came up to me and she said, oh, I heard that you're facilitating. And I said, yeah, my name is Monica, you know, we chit-chatted a bit. And she said, well, I just wanted to see if you were going to give an overview of how the consensus process works, because I just watched a video last night on it, and I just thought that if you needed somebody to do that I'm quite fresh with it. And so, you know, I don't have a lot of experience, but I just watched this video, so I know all about it. And I thought it was a sweet thing, you know, and I don't know, but also a fascinating thing, what the question for me of what happens that it gets into the social consciousness that this is the way that we will do things, even though it is not coming out of some kind of long-standing tradition of resistance. And I think that it means both things, right, that there is this incredible experimentation of how things happen, and also that people come and feel like they have no skills in what they're doing, and so they walk away feeling like, no, this does not make any sense. I think in the places where anarchists have been more involved, there has tried to be some balance of helping to share some of those skills, but also I think it's the kind of thing that you have to struggle through, right? You have to learn how to do over the course of many years. Any other questions?
Between the rich and poor.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a question about like a new generation coming up in the county without getting this work, you know, but you see that going on because years ago you already said like Seattle 99, you know, that was huge youngsters that came out of the street and we're still talking about it, like not the those things, but that's also the intention. But.
Yeah, no, I think that there definitely is this whole new generation, and I think that they're not only young people. You know, certainly for people of my era, Seattle does not mean the place, right, but it means this manifestation that happened against the WTO. Like, it still has this singular meaning because it was such a formative part of our lives. And I imagine in some ways that Occupy has the same kind of feeling for a lot of people. I think certainly it's been a lot of young people, but I have been the most surprised and impressed at how varied the age range has been, that it has not just been young people who are idealistic and old people who used to be involved in radical politics, but everyone in between, people who have never been politically active that are suddenly coming out in this very passionate way.
Because it's a bit of a media stream, or also in the media is also there.
I mean, the question of why is one that I would like to know also, right? If we could always figure out what happens that makes something catch in such a popular and contagious way, that it would be magical as anarchists to know. I wish that I could give more information about why it happens in this way.
Nobody does. I mean,
yeah. I think that your point. Yeah, I'm not totally sure of the question, but I do think that definitely the context in the U.S., again, is important, where there are so many people in every city that are unemployed and that are homeless. You know, it's very common in most cities that there are multiple camps of people who live without homes, who, have very little or no social welfare to live on. And so this, I think, problem is different than maybe it is in a lot of countries in Europe. And certainly when Occupy started, it was a mixture of people, but very much became a place where, okay, I have one friend now who lives in my town who I had known always as somebody who I assumed didn't have a home, that I met just occasionally on the street. We became friends at this Occupy encampment. And the first conversation that we had, I asked him, oh, you're staying at the camp, how do you like it? And he said, it is fucking great. It is the first time that I can say fuck you to the cops and they can't do shit. You know, he's a middle-aged black man who I think has been in and out of the prison system, and I think it was amazing for him and for some of his friends to be able to be in a space where, for once, all the people who usually just walk by them on the street are there protecting and defending them together, you know? I think that has definitely been one of the most interesting and transformative things to see, you know, especially seeing people who otherwise are quite comfortably middle class really engaging with people who they otherwise never would.
Different kinds of groups of people who call it and beliefs and things like that again, and then you write because capitalism is destroying something, but there has to be something else. So what I also was thinking about, and maybe you told them already, but I wasn't here, how the connection is with the Arabic Spring, you know, it's still going on because it's really life and death. But also the Spanish indigenous, the connection, do you get those information on the internet? But I mean,
yeah, I think it's interesting, particularly in this age where information spreads so quickly, right? I think it used to be that it felt like everything started only from one center point, whether that was somewhere in Europe or in the U.S., and then was transmitted from there. And that even when things are happening in the global south, right, that things don't spread in the other direction. And the things that happened in North Africa, the way that they spread and the way that they inspired people in Europe, in the US, is a fascinating study on how suddenly some place that is the margins can become the center. And because of the social media access that we have, things can spread from the margins like it is the middle of the world.
It does not end, and of course Occupy does also hopefully not end, because people already said here in Holland it's like really not like huge or
I think something that you said also is quite important, this connection between race and class lines, right? In the US, I think people are not very class conscious. Everyone in the US thinks that they are part of the middle class, right? There is no concept of working class in which people, and Occupy has started to shift that a little bit. And I think the other thing is that racial groups are incredibly segregated. I grew up in Ohio, which is the Midwest, and now I've lived for the last 8 years in North Carolina, which is the South. And it's dramatically different seeing how incredibly segregated white people are from black people, how incredibly segregated they are from Latino immigrants. And I think it's something that I don't know, it is very, very complicated to deal with, right? And I think it's something that especially anarchists, who even in the US are an incredibly white group of demographics, you know. I mean, looking around here, it certainly feels dramatically this way, but I think in the US it's also this way. And I think anarchists, and especially maybe the insurrectionary anarchist tendency, has this sort of clear desire almost to a fetishization of, you know, rioting with the black kids from the ghetto, right, of the people who are so marginalized that they feel the oppression of the state in the way that white people or middle class people just don't feel the urgency of the...
But do the youngsters catch up with the black thing, you know, black is beautiful, and the black panthers in those days, it was really like a movement, you know, and they were going to...
I think certainly race consciousness seems like more of a clearly prominent piece of radical organizing in the States than maybe how it is here, because there is such a strong history of race revolt in the US. And I think that it has been really exciting lately to see some of that shifting even more in that direction. With Occupy has been one thing, also with the anti-prison work that I'm involved in, there have been a number of organized efforts inside of prisons that have been organized across race and gang lines, which is really a really big deal to see a group of organizers inside of a prison who are white, who are black, who are Latino, who are from the Bloods, who are from the Crips, who are from the, you know, 5%ers, who are from all these different groups. And hopefully that is indicative of something, a direction that things will continue in.
Something totally different, because you mentioned the business level. He's still there. I mean, I thought he won the case that it shifted from lifelong to whatever.
Yes, he's not on death row anymore. He's moved to general population, which is a really big deal. You know, for the first time in many decades, his wife and other friends and family members were able to go and have visits with him, where they were actually able to touch him for the first time in so many years. And it's been a really big struggle, but I think also a really hard won struggle. I'm very good friends with one of Mia's sons who lives where I live, and he said that the fight for his father has been just so vicious in Pennsylvania that everybody who organizes on the outside from Mia faces incredible police harassment and, you know, a lot of intimidation from the police. I think a number of political prisoners from the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army are
and
coming
from the DLF, you know.
But a number of some of the older prisoners are coming up on their release and parole dates, and it's been fascinating to see that they're not getting let out. One prisoner in particular, Lorenzo Bowers, he is in prison in Georgia, and twice his release date has come up, which means that he has served his time according to the Bureau of Prisons rules and regulations. Twice it has happened that his release date has come up. His family has come to meet him, and just before he was to be released, somebody called the warden and said, he is not to be let out. He will not leave this prison. Because I think that people in the government are so afraid of what is possible if some of these very key figures who have been doing a lot of organizing inside of prisons very successfully get out onto the streets and continue organizing the way that they used to. So I think it's clear that there is a big and important line when it comes to organizing across race.
Is there something like the ABC in the area?
Yeah, there are a number of ABC groups in the U.S. and other kinds of prisoner support organizations.
Does it happen that people, activists, they can't recharge them, they can't put them in prison, but they put them in mental hospitals to shut them up?
In mental hospitals? I think this is not as common of a technique. I don't know about that happening a lot. I think often it's easy enough to stick false charges on somebody in the U.S. that it's not so hard to lock somebody up.
It happens here. They can say someone is a danger to society and someone maybe has a diagnosis of a mental illness, and it's very easy to just put them in the
I think being institutionalized happens also in the U.S., but I think it's so easy for somebody to be framed for something that they did not do and for the state to create.
Wat de 105.4 FM Radio Pinkslanddagen. Discussie is op dit moment een beetje lastig te volgen uit de zaal. We zetten nu de discussie ook even stop. Wat we ook even stopzetten is de livestream. Die gaan we even opnieuw herstarten vanaf een andere configuratie. Dan zal de geluidskwaliteit iets beter worden. We zijn zo terug, dus als jij nu eventjes geen verbinding hoort op jouw internetverbinding, dan komt dat omdat we hem even opnieuw opstarten. Dus bij deze.